I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Republican Senator Bob Corker had some choice words for the president this past weekend, tweeting, "It's a shame the White House has become an adult daycare center. Someone obviously missed their shift this morning." This extraordinary criticism from a relatively mild-mannered senator, who's head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, came after the president had attacked Corker on Twitter. And that was after Corker told reporters last week that Tillerson, Madison, Kelly are the people who separate our country from chaos. And adding fuel to the fire, Corker said this to the New York Times.
Sometimes I feel like he's on a reality show of some kind, you know, when he's talking about these big foreign policy issues. And you know, he doesn't realize that we could be heading towards World War III with the kind of comments that he's making.
I'm really glad our guests today are Norman Ornstein and E.J. Dion. They know more about our political system than most people, including most pundits. They're the authors with Thomas Mann of a new book called One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. Here's the first sentence from the book. American democracy was never supposed to give the nation a president like Donald Trump. We'll talk about how and why that happened and what they hope will happen after he's gone. And Norman Ornstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times once again and in the studio. And E.J. Dion, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with a question about Corker. I'll put this to you, Norman Ornstein, but E.J. Dion, I'd love to have you weigh in as well. When was the last time a member of Congress went public criticizing, even demeaning, not just the president, but the president who happens to be a member of their own party?
And that latter is the key part to this, Marty, because, of course, we've had members of Congress rip into presidents. I remember when Tom DeLay was the majority leader in the House of Representatives and said horrific things about Bill Clinton. We had plenty of members saying horrible things about Barack Obama. But those were not members of the president's own party and not leaders of the president's own party. So we haven't had anything like this. And the response from the president is also unlike anything we have ever seen.
And that's a tweet with a with the spelling of the word little, L-I-D-D-L-E. I'm not sure what to make of that.
It started, of course, with Trump belittling Corker after Corker had made a relatively mild statement, although it expressed some concern about the stability of the president. Trump simply cannot keep himself from going after people much harder if there's even the mildest criticism of them without thinking of the consequences for these individuals. You got 52 Republicans in the Senate, and if you completely alienate one who has actually voted with Trump and with Mitch McConnell, the leader, on every major bill so far, you are really playing with at least partisan fire.
Well, E.J. Dion, let me pick up on a couple of other things that Corker said, that he's speaking for the vast majority of our caucus. He also said, "I know for a fact that every single day at the White House, it's a situation of trying to contain him," him, of course, being the president. What can the public, what should the Republican Party do about their president?
Well, there's what the Republican Party should do and what they are likely to do in the short run. The last sentence, by the way, on the first page of our book is that this refers to the fact that Donald Trump has no business being president. And I think one of the things you've seen in the last week or week and a half, and Evan McMullen, a conservative anti-Trumper, tweeted this morning, that you are finally developing a kind of consensus in Washington that Trump is really unfit to be president. I mean, he unleashed this barrage against Corker that made no strategic sense for him, alienating, as Norm suggested, a very important Republican. But it was just outlandish that Trump does this with everybody, whether it's Hillary Clinton or little Marco Rubio, spelt with a T, not a D. You know, he's done this for a long time. And what's striking is there is reporter after reporter will tell you that in private, many Republicans in Congress say comparable things about Donald Trump, but they are afraid to say any of this publicly.
Why are they afraid?
They're afraid first because they are worried about the Republican primary electorate. One of the things that brought the three of us together on this book is we had written kind of companion books or sisterly or brotherly books over the last few years about the radicalization of the Republican Party. Tom and Norm wrote it's even worse than it looks, and I wrote why the right went wrong. And we were arguing that if you look over time at who constitutes the people who vote in Republican primaries, what the Republican leadership has been doing, they move from being a center-right party to a coalition of the right and the really far right. So Republicans are afraid of primaries. Second, they still hope to get some of their wish list through. They are desperate to get these tax cuts for the wealthy through. And third, Trump is giving them some of what they want, a lot of conservative judges, and all of these regulatory measures that the executive can do by itself, undercutting all sorts of things that the Obama administration did on the environment, on consumer protection, on workers' rights. So they're reluctant to break with him. And yet, Corker really did speak for what they know to be the case about Donald Trump.
Well, you write about a kind of Jurassic Park creation of the GOP, but they have, Norman Ornstein, you write, lost control of their creation.
And this is, you know, we use in the book this wonderful quote from John F. Kennedy, that if you ride on the back of the tiger, you can end up inside. And one of the things that we have here, stepping back even a little bit further, Republican leaders during the Obama years, and it goes back to the Clinton years as well, tried to exploit the anger of the base. And it was the Tea Party base during the Obama years, upset after the bailout in 2008. And they promised them all kinds of things and got them whipped up into a frenzy in a lot of ways. And it worked for them in 2010 and 2014. And it created the conditions for Donald Trump. And now they have not just Donald Trump, but the backlash coming from a base that believes that there is a deep state and a swamp, and somehow still bizarrely believe that Donald Trump and his Goldman Sachs allies are trying to drain that swamp.
Well, let me play a clip, and this is from Steve Bannon. He was actually interviewed on Hannity, Sean Hannity, talking with him about his plan to challenge every Republican senator up for re-election in 2018.
Is Steve Bannon declaring war on the establishment that are not for the working men and women in this country?
100%. We are declaring war on the Republican establishment that does not back the agenda that Donald Trump ran on and the President of the United States. And that is an agenda that we know backs the working men and women.
This is basically a war, because you know what McConnell did in Alabama. And you know there are people out there. Look at that.
I've had donors.
Carl Rove is going to put in all their money.
Carl Rove, Stephen Law, these guys should get the joke. Their donors are coming to us because they're tired of having their money burned up by trying to destroy people like Judge Moore. It's a new game in town. We're going to cut off the oxygen to Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell's biggest asset is the money. We're going to make it the biggest liability. We're going after these guys tooth and nail.
E.J. Dionne, do you think he speaks for the president? That's Steve Bannon, of course.
I don't think the president's views are consistent one day to the next. I think here's what I think is going on, that Steve Bannon and Donald Trump had a kind of alliance of convenience, that Donald Trump had certain instincts that were Bannon-like, particularly in his harshness toward immigrants, and a kind of generally right-wing nationalist perspective. That's what they had in common. Trump decided he could use Bannon to become president. Bannon decided he could use Trump to foster this agenda. Then Trump, who is inconstant to a friend, many friends, decides that this isn't working. Bannon gets bounced. And I think what Bannon was trying to do in that Republican primary in Alabama, where he supported Judge Roy Moore, this radical right judge, against a very conservative Republican called Luther Strange, was to send Trump a message. Trump endorsed Strange, the so-called establishment candidate. And Bannon was trying to tell Trump, you may think your people will follow you anywhere. I am telling you that your people actually believe this right-wing agenda, and you better follow us. So Bannon is playing this kind of inside-outside game, and you seen in recent days that Trump has responded to Bannon. He looked like he was going to make a deal, Trump did, with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer on DACA, on the immigrants who came here as kids illegally brought here by their parents. who have obeyed the law, have graduated high school, been really good Americans. Trump was ready to make a deal. Then he comes out with this really hardcore set of demands. He pumped up this NFL fight, which clearly appeals to the base that Bannon is speaking to. And so the paradox is that the worst trouble Trump gets into, the more he may move to the right. And that's all a victory for Steve Bannon.
Let me go. You want to say something, Norm Ornstein?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Just a couple of things. Trump is issue-free, substance-free, cares about winning, and isn't winning. And so, first, he had the backlash against Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan. We know that he was ridiculing McConnell and his physical attributes and John McCain. They weren't giving him the victories. The second part of this, and that's part of the war on your own leaders, but the second part of it is that this base that he has appealed to, that support has been declining. In states like Mississippi and Alabama, his support is down 20% or more. And instead of doing what you would normally find with a president, trying to broaden that base, what he's doing now as those numbers decline is to double down on the kinds of things that Steve Bannon loves, but that's designed to bring that base back. He's perfectly happy if he has that 35 to 40% with him no matter what. And that's why he's made this sharp turn now away from a deal on the Dreamers, with a much tougher stand on health care, with an immigration plan that is even more to the right than we had seen before, and with some of his harsh rhetoric involving the NFL and the African-American players.
But do we pay too much attention to all the things the president either says or tweets, and to the, not the detriment, but that we ignore the actual impact that he is having on our country? E.J. Dan, about a minute before our first break here.
Yes and no. Well, we pay too much attention if we ignore what he's doing to healthcare, what he's doing to workers' rights, what he's doing to consumers, what he's doing to the courts. And we can't keep our eyes off that. On the other hand, the president is accountable for what he says, and you have to pay attention to these radical and, in many cases, dangerous tweets about North Korea, for example, because he is president of the United States. This is how he communicates. So we have to keep our eyes on two things at once: what he's saying and the crazy stuff he's saying, but also what he's doing. And if you lose sight of either of those, you're missing what's going on.
And that's E.J. Dionne, who joins us along with Norman Ornstein. They are co-authors with Thomas Mann of a new book called One Nation After Trump. And it's subtitled A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. And you can join us by calling 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with E.J. Dionne and Norman Ornstein about their new book, One Nation After Trump. Norman, could you say on the air what we were talking about during the break off the air about the president and, frankly, the nuclear button?
So, you know, the expectations when the system was created were that we had enough checks and balances that we wouldn't end up with an unhinged president, and that the president would have, in the end, the unfettered ability to use nuclear weapons. And there are stories that Secretary of Defense Mattis, Secretary of State Tillerson, Chief of Staff Kelly have talked about how they might have to gang tackle the president if he was heading towards that nuclear button. So, you know, we're not just looking at some of the things that EJ was talking about, which are devastating to the country. Regulations that now, you know, will take all of the controls off coal-powered plants, remove worker safety and the like. We're also dealing with existential threats from somebody who might not even think about what the consequences would be.
Well, and Corker talked about World War III. This is a test, I think, the way Watergate was, a test of our institutions. How were they performing, yeah. Norman Ornstein?
And, you know, you go back to Alexander Hamilton writing about how they were going to create a system that would keep us from having an Aaron Burr type as president, somebody without values, somebody who could not be trusted with power. And that relies in part on a Congress being an independent branch. And we are not seeing Congress perform as an independent branch. The fact that no other Republican senator, they like Bob Corker, has stood firmly behind him as he's been out there under attack. The fact that we haven't had a single hearing on the kleptocracy in the administration, including all of these cabinet members using taxpayer money for private jets for personal purposes, including the president and his family and the dealings that they've had with their businesses, that we continue to have in the House of Representatives the chairman of the Intelligence Committee intervening to try and block the Russian investigation. None of those things are working the way they were supposed to, and that is a deeply, deeply troubling element.
I think it's always
Why are they not working, though? EJDM?
Well, I think it's always worth asking ourselves, what would Republicans in Congress say if Hillary Clinton were accused of any one of these things, or if a Clinton administration were accused of any one of these things? And we know what the answer to that is. Just to go back to your Watergate question, which I think is a good one, and we write about Watergate in the book. You know, first of all, in some ways, and I was very anti-Nixon back in the day, in some ways, I think it's very unfair to Richard Nixon to compare Donald Trump to him.
Truly, because
wow. Richard Nixon was a serious man about a lot of policies. He actually was quite willing to sign bills put in front of him by Democrats to create the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. I mean, Nixon was serious about governing, but he had these problems with abusing power. And it took a while. We remember the sort of bipartisanship at the end of Watergate, but it took a while for Republicans to come around and say, my God, he really has to leave. But in those days, you had a much more ideologically, philosophically diverse Republican Party that included a lot of people who from the beginning were skeptical about Watergate. Here you have a much less philosophically diverse Republican Party. And the few who were there, like Charlie Dent up here in the Philly area, is leaving. He's leaving. And so, and there's talk that Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, might run for governor of Maine instead of staying in the Senate. So what few non-right-wing Republicans or people, I think, in Dent and Collins' case, you can call genuine moderates, are departing. So you just don't even have the checks at this point that you had during Watergate. Having said that, you've got to hope that if Mr. Mueller comes up with some genuinely damning information, and we'll find out. I don't want to prejudge what he'll find. But if he does, there will be more Republicans saying, okay, now it's time to act. Mm. We can't sort of turn the other way.
Well, let me go back to the day that Donald Trump descended I think it's a golden escalator at Trump Tower when he announced that he was running for president as a Republican. And Norman Ornstein, what we know is that he could have easily been a Democrat, but he chose the Republican Party. You both, or the three of you, write in your book about the party creating this environment for someone like Trump to be its leader, some of it having to do with Nixon and Agnew, having to do with Ronald Reagan, you know, basically saying government is the problem, Newt Gingrich. Spell that out for us.
So there was certainly a backdrop here. And the backdrop, we argue, at one level goes back decades to the decline of community, the kind of atomization that we've seen in the country. We reference Bowling Alone, the book by Bob Putnam, and The Big Sort. But it was also efforts made by Gingrich going back to the late 1970s to tribalize American politics and divide it and create a disgust with Washington that he hoped would lead to a national tide where people, because the Democrats had a hammerlock on power in Congress, would lead to a view of throw them all out, and that would bring in the Republicans.
A kind of warfare, I guess.
A warfare, and it worked, but at an enormous cost. And at the same time, we were beginning to see some of these divisions as the demographics were changing relentlessly in the country, leading us towards what will be a majority of minorities in the country. And we had unease over economics and exacerbated by the populist uprising after the financial collapse and the bailout. And all of that set conditions, I think, and many of them, as we were saying a little bit earlier, incited by Republican leaders for their own narrow short-term purposes. And that led us to believe that, unlike the usual pattern that follows with Republicans, where they choose a presidential candidate after flirting with an outsider, but it's always the heir apparent, obvious figure, that an outsider might prevail. Donald Trump emerged earlier, of course, by capturing the leadership of the birther movement.
That's right.
And that, by taking on Barack Obama in a vicious and racist way and not letting go of it no matter what, gave him credibility with a core in the party base. And yet you could have said that when he came in as a candidate, he was one, a curiosity, one among many, Ben Carson, Carly Fiorina, and Ted Cruz, among others. What made him stand out, two or three things that are important. One, when he got to the right of everybody else on the immigration issue with the Mexican rapists and the wall and the Muslim ban. Two, by belittling the other candidates and even taking on Fox News and Megyn Kelly. And he was saying, unlike these Republican leaders who said that they would bring Barack Obama to his knees and did none of the things they promised, nobody is going to stand in my way. And that enabled him to emerge.
Well, let me ask you, E.J. Dionne, how much do you think President Barack Obama, our first black president, led to the election of Donald Trump?
You know, that's a complicated question. I think there is certainly, if you look at the Trump constituency, a strong element of racial backlash. We have a whole chapter in the book that talks about whether this is about race, immigration, culture, or economics. And first, these things can't be easily disentangled, that voters who are feeling, white voters who are feeling under real economic stress, not made up economic stress, but real economic stress, are more likely to go with backlash than if they felt the system was being fairer to them. So you can't deny that race and nativism were central to Trump's appeal, and he made them central in a way, it should be noted, that neither John McCain or Mitt Romney did when they ran against Barack Obama. So clearly there is race is a big part of this, and Obama being president is part of this. But there's also this element, and we are kind of critical of elites as well in the book, because there has been a long period of rising inequality going back a ways. It really started taking off in a big way, actually, in the George W. Bush administration, but it began really back in the 1970s. And this is a problem that if we want to defeat Trump and avoid Trumpism in the future, we are going to have to grapple with. Now, President Obama put forward some ideas about dealing with that after the 2010 election were just unpassable in a Republican Congress. I think you can argue, and we make the point in the book, that Democrats, when they did control the Congress and the White House, probably should have tried to move more aggressively, not just on health care. I don't fault them for doing it because it was necessary, but also on some of these economic fronts while they had the chance to do it, which would have sent a signal to some of these voters that, yes, we get it, you're hurting.
Let me quote you from your book. You write, the most disturbing aspect of Trumpism is its dark pessimism about liberal democracy and open society and the achievements of the American experiment. Picking up on what you both said, there are millions of people in this country, not just Republicans, who are not enjoying the achievements of the American experiment, whether it largely has to do with economics.
And a good part of what we suggest is the travails of the working class are not the travails of the white working class. They are the travails of working class voters of every type and stripe. And if we're going to make our way out of this, and it's important to emphasize, this is not a book about Trump so much as it is a book about Trumpism, or what we could call Trumpism. It's a larger set of forces in the society that have driven us apart in many ways that are real challenges to the future. They don't disappear if Donald Trump happens to disappear. And this economic challenge it can be a way for us to unite people who are currently divided. You know, one of the things we were at the Philadelphia Free Library last night, and one of the things we were talking about, when people ask me what analogies do you have in history, of course, the first one that comes up is the period right before the Civil War, which you really don't want to use as an analogy.
I like that people have talked about our being in a cold Civil War.
Yeah, cold Civil War.
And there is
yeah.
something to that, yeah. which is kind of scary.
It is very scary.
But I also talk about the period after the war, the Reconstruction period, where you had black and white sharecroppers, poor people, working people who had an awful lot in common and an elite exploiting them. And what that elite did was use race as a wedge, and it unleashed a really dark period that we are not out of yet to keep them from uniting together. And if we can find policies, and a good part of our book in the last third is looking at the kinds of policies that could get broad support, not just progressives, that can convince people that their interests are being protected and that those interests are not just on one side or one race or another.
I am struck by the fact...
Go ahead.
Just a quick point on that, because that's really important to us in the book. If you go back to the 1963 Great Civil Rights March in Washington, the slogan of that march was jobs and freedom. And the slogan that people like Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph and a young John Lewis understood is that economic justice and racial justice go hand in hand. And what we have right now is a politics that tries to cast one group's pain against another group's pain. That is a recipe for division and inaction. And that's what we have to overcome if we want to defeat Trump and Trumpism.
And Norm Ornstein, as you were describing Reconstruction, that, of course, gave rise to the KKK. Do you see parallels between that period and the neo-Nazis that we saw marching in Charlottesville?
Well, there's some very fine people in the KKK.
Right? You're going to stand
I
by
hope
that?
Nobody quotes you out of context.
And of course,
we will not quote you on that.
That is the parallel with Donald Trump. And what is as disturbing as anything about Trump is the fact that he has used his position as president of the United States, president of all of us, to encourage and enable these dark forces, including somewhat bizarrely the anti-Semitic forces along with the racist ones. And instead of taking them on, and this fits the Bannon strategy, the so-called alt-right, which was really an attempt to create a sanitized name for evil forces in the society, one that's being pushed forward now that he is back at Breitbart with a lot of financial backing from billionaires like the Mercers. And it is a formula for very, very bad things. And if you add to that this sense, this drumbeat that the deep state is after him, the attempt to get out from under the Mueller investigation and all of the other criticisms with the idea that this is a cabal of elites, you combine the race with a conspiracy theory, and that's something that we've seen in other societies that leads to very bad things, and it's one of the great dangers we have. We have to worry about a nuclear war at the same time, but this, in terms of having a society that could either find the way to unite together again with a new patriotism, it is a critical element, or it could come apart at the seams.
And what about the sort of authoritarianism that we hear, and even the appeal of someone saying, you know, basically, I'm going to fix this.
I alone can fix it, yeah. He said, which is a classic autocratic leader's take. And what we try to do in the book is not be alarmist, but insist that we can't be complacent. And I think when you look at Trump's trajectory, it does match what autocrats have done in other countries in beginning slowly to dismantle democracy and small R Republican freedoms. You attack the courts. You attack the press and try to discredit the entire the parts of the press that are reporting things about you that you don't like. You try to confuse people about what the truth is.
You invent the word fake.
Exactly. And then you also demonize your opponents. I mean, look, we've had rough politics before. We're in Philly. Philly in mayor's races. You've had plenty of rough mayor's races. So it's not about tough politics. It's about completely undercutting the legitimacy of your opposition. And that's what happens when Erdogan in Turkey is a good example. Orban in Hungary is a good example. Now, we're not there yet. And fortunately, we are free to sit around these microphones and say what we say, thank God. But Trump has these autocratic and authoritarian streaks in him that we all have to keep an eye on. And, you know, in the book, we talk about the anti-Trump conservatives who are going to be, who I think are very important, even if not many of them are politicians, because this is at least one branch of the conservative movement that is saying that these basic freedoms under liberal democracy, small L, small D, that we're going to defend, even if this guy is a Republican president, and we're going to deny these conservatives, argue that he's a conservative. And we need a very broad alliance of us to oppose these tendencies.
We're almost up in a break here, but Norman, you write in the book about the media. I mean, that Trump, obviously, I mean, he says he hates the media, but you also write that he has needed the media and in a certain way has a love relationship with the media because he needs their attention.
And they give him that attention. And of course, if you go back to the campaign, billions and billions of dollars of free airtime. EJ was talking last night about being home in the kitchen one day and turning on a cable channel and it's a Trump press conference. And then every place you turned, it was. And I remember the moment when Hillary Clinton was giving a deep speech about what to do about working class individuals and families in the country. And Trump was just at the point where North Dakota was going to give him the delegates he needed to win the nomination. For a half an hour, three cable networks had an empty podium. They've enabled him. He hates them, but they're giving him the attention that he wants, and that they are the enemies of the people, that charged phrase that even Khrushchev wouldn't use, that he's used against the press.
And that's Norman Ornstein, who joins us along with E.J. Dionne. They've got a new book, One Nation After Trump, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with E.J. Dionne. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University, and Norman Ornstein. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor and columnist for National Journal and The Atlantic, and they are authors with Thomas Mann of a new book, One Nation After Trump. You both believe in parties. I mean, that's very clear, having read your book. Where, E.J. Dionne, does all of this leave the Democratic Party?
Every party, after it loses an election, particularly an election it didn't expect to lose, takes some time to get its act together, and that's certainly true of the Democrats. On the other hand, I think one of the single most important things that's happened in Congress since Trump got elected is the defeat not of one but of two efforts to repeal Obamacare. Now, that happened because a handful of Republicans, notably John McCain, but also Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, said, we are not going to vote for this. But that wouldn't have been possible if the entire Democratic Party, from Joe Manchin on the more on the conservative end to Bernie Sanders on the left end, had not united and said, we are not going to permit this. And so I think there's a lot of talk of deep splits in the Democratic Party. And there are differences among Democrats.
Clearly.
Between, you know, some people would call it the Clinton wing and the Sanders wing, or between the left and the center left. And those differences are going to have to be worked out. But what's really striking, and a conservative columnist wrote about this recently, I forgot who it is, forgive me, that, you know, Democrats may have some differences on means. For example, do you do single payer or do you build on Obamacare? But they agree on a lot of ends, which is to say, let's cover everybody with health insurance. And I think there's also more and more agreement that that opposing Trump is such an important priority that some of these other differences need to be held in check. I do think there may be, and Norm talked about this last night, a kind of generational fight coming in the party that has a connection to ideology, but is actually quite distinct from ideology, and a desire of younger leadership to push its way up. Usually that's healthy at a political party when a younger leadership wants to emerge, but it could lead to some some discord.
Let me put something else on the table that you write about, Norman Ornstein, and then we got callers and comments as well. A really interesting part of the book is about what you call minority rule, between gerrymandering, between that and the Electoral College, and other, I guess, political tools, even voter suppression or voter ID.
Yeah.
We've created a country where really the minority rules.
So we don't have a pure democracy. We have a republic. It's a Republican small r form of democracy. But it's still one where the people make their choices and choose representatives and through filters, including the Electoral College, choose a president. But all of this has gone very much out of whack since the framers created a system. The Electoral College, of course, was supposed to have individuals of great merit as electors actually weeding out the unsavory candidates. That's gone. But most significantly, back when the framers set the system with the Electoral College and the Senate, the ratio between the largest and smallest state was 13 to 1. Right. Now it's 70 to 1. Right. The most chilling figure I think that we use in the book is that by 2050 or before, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. That means we're going to have a Senate where 30% of Americans will control 70 senators. We have a system where For 44 elections, we had basically only one where it was clear that the president lost the popular vote in a way that mattered. Two out of the last five. You cannot have legitimacy in a system if you go on where a minority has the power and the majority wants to move in a particular direction, and the system cannot move.
So what do you do about that, EJ Dion?
Well, I just want to add one point to that, which is that a good example of why this minority rule stops us from acting is gun control. Your Senator Toomey, along with Senator Manchin, two quite conservative members of Congress, had a background checks bill. It got 54 votes in the Senate. First, it was blocked because of the filibuster. It couldn't get to 60. Those 54 senators represented 63% of the American population, which meant that senators representing 37% of us were able to block even a very mild gun reform bill. That's the kind of thing that's happening systematically. And the gerrymander is distorting results for the House of Representatives. The Brennan Center in New York estimates that the Republicans, they have a majority of, 23 now, 24 if they win the seat that's open. At least 16 of those come from districts that are drawn to distort the vote. That means two-thirds of their majority comes from the gerrymander. The Senate is very hard to change. We're really going to have to struggle with that because the Constitution makes it almost impossible to change. We can change the gerrymander both through action at state level. And there's a very interesting case before the Supreme Court where if Justice Kennedy joins the four more liberal members, which is at least possible, we could begin to have fairer drawing of districts. We also talk about the distortion of big money in politics. There are ways of going back to a regime that fixes that. We can also fight voter suppression. We can pass a new Voting Rights Act. We can have universal voter registration. There are a lot of steps we can take. And then lastly, we are very sympathetic to an effort by states to form a compact where states representing a majority of electors agree to vote for the winner of the popular vote, we could create a de facto popular vote for president, which would be a lot better than this system, which I think is going to go haywire again, given the lack of fit between the Electoral College and where we live now. That the metropolitanization of the country means the Electoral College will be more and more distortive of the actual results.
As the country, I guess, becomes more urbanized and all of that.
Yeah.
Let me just get some callers in. I got a bunch of comments here as well. Let me read some comments from Felix. Do the guests think Trump is an anomaly of American politics or the creation of American politics? And it seems like you both are saying that it's probably both, but a creation and an anomaly. A tweet says, I feel like Trump is trying to divide us. An email from Paul, how about Trump getting China involved in slowing down North Korea, Syria no-fly zone, getting ISIS out of Libya or out of Iraq and Libya? We need some balance to this rhetoric. Let me get David from Roxborough to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I think a strong possibility for Trumpism is that the problems of our society and people in it require a lot more social democracy. But our deep belief system, based on hyper-capitalism and rugged individualism, are antithetical to that. And for a lot of people to feel that they have hope and control in their lives and for their future, that they turn to championing a closed society and scapegoating, of which that giant eyesore wall is symbolic.
Well, David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. EJ, looks like you want to say something.
Yeah. I think we have seen over and over again that capitalism, with few rules and no effort to redress the inequalities capitalism produces, will collapse. You know, it's very significant that there are two times in our history when we have been this unequal in our distribution of income. The first time was 1928 and 1929, and we got the Great Depression. And the second time was now, right before the Great Recession. Capitalism needs adjustment. And the way capitalism or the market system has been saved is that reformers, from democratic socialists to sort of more middle-of-the-road reformers, have agreed that we need systems ranging from Social Security and federalized health insurance, at least in the case of Medicare, government spending, some redistribution, protections for the rights of labor, which have virtually disappeared, to redress these inequalities. That the paradox is capitalism needs its critics if it's going to survive. FDR understood that. Social Democrats in Europe understood that. And if we simply let this system create these vast gulfs, not only across racial lines and between individuals, but also from one region to another or from one part of a state to another, then our society is in trouble and our economy is in trouble.
Well, in fact, you have in your book, Norman Ornstein, the Charter for American Working Families. You talk about a GI bill for the American worker, a new patriotism. You mentioned that earlier. The question is, how would we do this?
Sure. And a compact to change corporate governance in America. One comment just to follow on, EJ. The Affordable Care Act was capitalism with some boundaries around it. It was creating competition by companies, but where you knew what was in the plans. And Bill Frist, a former Senate Majority Leader, a physician whose family conservative Republican, whose family had been in this healthcare provider business for many decades, the other day said, you know, this was really good piece of legislation that needed some adjustments. That what the Republicans are trying to do is an unfettered kind of capitalism where you can get a plan and you're told it's wonderful, it's so cheap, except it doesn't cover anything when anything happens. And that, I think, follows on what EJ was saying. We have it's not a laundry list, really. It's a sort of coherent set of proposals to try to fulfill a social contract. If you work and you do what you're supposed to do in the society and you show up and you do your job, you should be able to get a roof over the heads of yourself and your family, food to put on the table, education for your kids, and some family coherence.
I have heard that before, though.
Yes.
I've heard that many times.
And there are policies, including some that have been proposed or are supported by free market conservative intellectuals, not so much those in public office, that can join with progressives. And if we can start to turn this around, we can actually create some hope in people.
And we have done
very
this
quickly, because I want to get Tony.
We've done this before in our history. We talk about the GI Bill as a model for what we can do as a country. The GI Bill invested in a middle class and in educating people and helping them buy houses, in some cases starting businesses. This was a case where a significant but still pretty modest intervention by government help create a fairer society, but also a more productive society.
Let me get Tonya from East Norriton to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, Tonya, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'm Tonya Brown, and I want to say that I do believe in what the gentleman's saying about after civil war. My question is, why do you have so much hope? I think that we're closer to a civil war. The only thing that brought us together after the civil war was two world wars. And I just feel at this time the country is just too passive to go against what Trump is doing.
Well, Tonya, I appreciate the call. I'm going to give EJ Dion a chance to respond.
And I think Barack Obama once said that people criticized him for being a hope monger. And in a way, Norm and I are both hope mongers. A couple of things. First of all, yes, Norm and I both love John McCain's line where he said that things get dark before they go completely black. So, yes, there are reasons to be fearful. But we think that Trump has given a jolt to the system and to a lot of people. We see and write about in the book the extraordinary amount of activism you see both in the political sphere and in civil society in pushing back against Trump. We see a country that is far more aware than it used to be, all of us are, that when you have leadership that systematically violates norms, that things that aren't written in the rules, but you expect a president to live by, when those go by the boards, we have lost something. I think Americans are more aware of that. I think Americans are more aware than they were before of the rise of a real extremist ideology. And for example, take Charlottesville. This was a horrible thing. It is worth noting how much pushback there was against Trump and against the existence of Klansmen and Nazis on the streets of Charlottesville, a wonderful town, by the way. I hate that it has been sort of tagged with this so that we see a lot of action in the country aimed at fighting back against these tendencies. I want my fellow hope monger to have a word.
Well, you know what?
That.
Let me ask your hope monger about an article, article. The title is American Kakistocracy. Norman Ornstein, explain.
So kakistocracy is a term that goes back to the 17th century. It fell into disuse and has emerged now. It comes from a Greek word. It means government by the worst and most unscrupulous among us. That can also be extended to the worst kind of government. And we are in the middle of a kakistocracy. And in this article that I wrote in The Atlantic, and of course all of this flows from what we were writing in the book and about the book. So don't just read the article by the book. But
thank you, Norm.
Where does your hope come from?
But you look at the kleptocracy and the refusal of a Congress to do anything about it, an inept Congress that has blown up all of its own rules, and the disarray in the executive branch, the president at war with his own Secretary of State, dissing his own Secretary of Defense over the Iran deal, and a lot more that I could have written. And that's all terrible. But let's get back to what EJ said. It's a jolt. And we have an opportunity here for people to suddenly realize, and we have to work at this. It's going to take all of us working at it. We are in the same boat. The boat is America. We can make it sink. We can saw it in half. Or we can try and find a way. Separating out that core group of really evil people. There are racists and anti-Semites and people who want to destroy what we have, and Russians as well. We can find a way to create a new patriotism and come back together and work to solve some of these problems. It's doable if we work at it.
Well, we're ending on a positive note. My thanks to both of you, Norman Ornstein and EJ Dion. Thanks for joining us today on Radio
Times.
Thanks
so much for having us.
What a great conversation.
Thank you so much. And their book is called One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us on NPR's satellite channel. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.